Hello again. Welcome back to the F This Movie podcast, the official podcast of the F This Movie podcast. I am Patrick Bromley, and joining me once again is Mr. Alex Lawson. How are you, Alex?
I'm doing okay. Really, really, really excited to be here because I have some really strong feelings about the film we're discussing today. I'm excited to share them with you and our fives of listeners.
We have fives of listeners?
Fives, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I'm just guessing. Mostly friends and relatives, right?
Yeah, well, probably not relatives.
Oh, okay. Just close friends.
Yeah, and hopefully you have friends. I have very few friends, so I don't even think I can get up to five listeners.
We're out of luck on that. Let's just do it for us then.
How about that? Yay!
Yeah, we'll have fun.
Tonight, we are discussing the 1991 superhero movie / potential franchise disaster, The Rocketeer.
Yes.
Which is a movie that you chose, Alex, because you hold it very near and dear to your heart.
If by near and dear to my heart, you mean I consider it to be a nearly flawless film that has everything, then yeah, it's pretty,
wow. Interesting.
Pretty near and dear.
I'm going to let you take point on talking about The Rocketeer a little bit in terms of just giving it a brief introduction and maybe just going through the main story beats. I don't know how much of a plot summary we need to give The Rocketeer. And once again, let me give the disclaimer up front that if you have not seen The Rocketeer, there's a good chance that we will be spoiling elements of The Rocketeer for you. So tune out if you've not seen The Rocketeer and want to see it without having it spoiled by Alex and myself. If you want it to be spoiled by the two of us, then you are in fucking luck tonight.
You came to the right place. We're going to spoil the shit out of it. Okay. Well, it's a wonderful, wonderful tale. I'm not editorializing here by any means. These are facts that I'm saying. It takes place in late 1930s Hollywood, California.
It immerses that's Tinseltown.
From what I understand, and actually it was so long ago that the sign, the Hollywood sign, said
Hollywoodland.
It said Hollywoodland.
Which let's shift gears. Let's talk about Hollywoodland.
Okay.
Starring Ben Affleck and Adrian Brody. I'm kidding. I don't want to talk about that movie.
No one does. Where the hell was I? I didn't get very far in my synopsis. Okay. So we're introduced to our hero. His name is Cliff Secord. He's portrayed by Billy Campbell. He's something of a hotshot flyboy pilot who's just on the verge of, like, what's he doing? He's, like, about to launch his like, you know, great plane that's going to get him to the national championships.
Right.
He gets swept up in some intrigue because a band of gangsters have stolen a top secret rocket pack flying device from Howard Hughes. Long story short, he comes into possession of this rocket pack, and it's of great interest to a certain high-ranking Hollywood actor by the name of Neville Sinclair, who's played by the great Timothy Dalton. We don't exactly know why he wants it. Seems sort of weird that an actor would want this top secret rocket project. But come to find out, he's actually a high-ranking undercover Nazi. And of course, merchandise like this, very special to the Nazis. Jennifer Connelly is in it as Cliff's girlfriend, Jenny. And she, of course, is kidnapped at some point. Something of a damsel in distress. What else am I missing here? It's all great.
Just Alan Arkin as Peavy.
Oh, that's right. That's right. He's, you know, sort of the wise, grizzly pilot
who
sort of perfects the flying device. He also makes the kick-ass helmet that he wears, which I'm sure you've seen. He also delivers the line that was in every trailer when he says, "How do I look?" And he says, "Like a hood ornament."
That's a pretty good Alan Arkin. I like that you bust out impressions early and often.
So anyway, the whole thing's very nostalgic. It was based on a comic book that was actually released in the early 80s, right? But it was
a throwback to
the pulp books of the 30s and 40s.
That threw me because I think for a long time I thought the comic book really was written, you know, in the 30s and 40s where the story is based. I was kind of thrown off to find out it didn't start up until the 80s.
So, I mean, it's that's sort of an interesting place to start, just in that there's sort of cashing in on some nostalgia, on something that was already being nostalgic for something a way long time ago.
Right.
I really like it because of this. It's a really fun movie, even before you realize that there are Nazis involved. You come, the reveal of Timothy Dalton as a Nazi comes, like, halfway through the movie. And before that, you're just sort of immersed in this old-time Hollywood culture. Jennifer Connelly's portraying an actress. She's like an extra on the set. He visits her on the set and gives one of my favorite lines in the movie. He says, "Honey, you're walking through the scenery here." And she's like, "This is an important job." I feel like we're not on on the level here. What are your issues with The Rocketeer?
When did I say I had issues with The Rocketeer?
Maybe you don't. I just feel like you don't like it as much as I do, maybe.
I like it a lot. I will say this.
Okay.
Before rewatching it for the purposes of F This Movie, I didn't remember that it's a movie that has some problems. And I know you've introduced the conversation by saying it's a near perfect movie.
Well,
and I'm not trying to blow holes in your theory. I think the only issues I had were issues of pace. Because I noticed watching it this time around, I'd say the first half is really, really excellent. And then they get to that scene in the diner where Cliff and the gang that hangs out at the airstrip has to fight some gangsters, because there's a whole gangster subplot to Paul Sorvino.
I neglected to mention, as Eddie Valentine.
Right, that they're trying to get back the Rocket Pack. And then there's a great turn at the end where the gangsters find out that they're doing it for the Nazis, and they're like, "Fuck that, USA." And that's kind of great. So they have to fight these gangsters at the diner, and then he has to go rescue Jenny. And then there's like another 45 minutes in the movie, and I felt like that scene should have been sort of ramping up to the climax, but it doesn't. There's a lot of dead space between that scene and then, you know, by the time we actually get up
on the blimp,
the dirigible.
Yes. The whole thing culminates on a swastika emblazoned zeppelin flying over Hollywood. Tell me where this is not fun.
No, it's
always
is a ton of fun. I really like the movie. I think it's really underrated. But I didn't remember those pacing issues until watching it this time through again. It doesn't make it a bad movie or an unsuccessful one. It's just I think I remembered it being more perfect than it actually is.
Okay.
That's all.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's like the first note I actually made. Actually, that's not true. It was the last note I made because it was when it was over. But it's the first thing I wanted to talk about.
Oh, all right. My first note was Jennifer Connelly. Holy shit!
Yes. Well, that goes without saying, but we'll keep saying it several times. This came out in 1991. I was 6 years old when I saw it, and I remember going. It was one of the first movies I saw in the theater.
Oh wow!
And so yeah. And so, to some degree, my perspective on this movie will always be sort of colored in that fashion.
Right.
I'll always hold it sort of near and dear. But the note that I made is that sometimes when you like movies like that, like that you liked when you were a kid, when you like everything, sometimes you come back to them and you're like really disappointed. But then sometimes you come back to them and you remember that they're really, really as great as you remember. And that's what happened to me. It sounds like you had a different thing. When you rewatched it, you noticed more problems. I noticed more perfection.
Wow. Okay.
It's not perfect. I know it's not nearly flawless. It is a lot of fun, though. And,
yeah.
To sort of pinpoint your thing, your issue with the pacing, do you then have a problem with the whole sequence in the South Seas Club? Because that's what comes between the thing you're talking about and sort of the end of it, isn't it?
Or
yeah,
it
come before.
No, because he leaves the diner to go to the South Seas Club, right?
Yeah.
And right. I guess that, and I wouldn't even necessarily have a problem with that if then there wasn't a bunch more dead space where Neville Sinclair makes off with Jenny. And there's a long sequence where she sort of seduces him and then knocks him out and says, "I finally got to have a scene with Neville Sinclair." But I really like the scene at the South Seas Club. Even though the weird W.C. Fields impersonator is a little bit distracting. But I like all that shit. The Clark Gable.
So do I.
I like the
Clark Gable guy, yeah.
I like that the movie is placed in that sort of classic Hollywood era. And Timothy Dalton, it should be mentioned. Neville Sinclair, it's never explicitly said, but he seems very specifically based on Errol Flynn.
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear.
And especially why that is, I don't know why they decided to make Errol Flynn a Nazi, but fuck him.
Well, I mean, he was sort of, wasn't he like sort of gay or something?
Errol Flynn, sort of gay. Why do you equate sort of gay with Nazi?
No, I'm not saying that. Weird. I don't mean to offend any gays or Nazis who are listening, but I mean just that. It's some sort of thing being hidden is all I mean.
Right. Yeah. Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Something being concealed. That's all I meant.
Right.
Talking about the South Seas Club scene, did we notice there's a slew of fun? Well, you can't really call them cameos because they weren't really famous people yet. But did you notice who the singer was?
I did for the first time ever. Yes.
Right. Isn't that great? Jan Levinson Gould. And she looks the same.
Yeah.
I mean, she looks like she walked off the set of The Office. This was 14 years before The Office. That was a great little treat because I did not remember that or even, you know, I hadn't watched this apparently since The Office has been on.
Yeah.
Doesn't
Clint Howard show up in like
Clint Howard? Yeah, that's the next one on my list, yo.
Nice.
Clint Howard, which just all he does is whisper in Neville's ear.
Right. He doesn't even talk. Let me say this though about Melora Hardin. The next day, maybe, or 2 days after I watched The Rocketeer, Soul Man was on cable. There's a scene where some hot girl like shows up in her underwear in his bedroom and he has to hide her from his girlfriend, Ray Dawn Chong. But it's Melora Hardin. I was like, holy shit, she was getting all kinds of work pre-Office, and I was totally unaware of it, but now twice in one weekend.
The other reason I really like the South Seas Club sequence. This is an odd place to sort of have to start our conversation, but whatever. We're just going with it. I really like the staging of it in that it's undersea themed, and I like that clamshell stage set piece because then when he flies around it, it enables him to knock a bunch of musicians into the water, which just is hilarious to me.
Yeah.
And that's before Sinclair takes the Tommy gun and doesn't shoot him, but chooses to shoot the net to trap him like a fly when he could just blow his brains out.
Here's something we can talk about with The Rocketeer, because originally it was supposed to be released under Disney's Touchstone label, which was sort of their more adult studio. The rated R movies that Disney produced always came out of Touchstone, but Disney decided to release it, I think, because they thought that they could market it in such a way where they would be able to get action figures and like fast food tie-ins out of it. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of a very PG rated movie, despite the fact that it has Nazis and this big prosthetic faced goon who bends people in half.
Name is Lothar.
Yeah.
That's his name.
And he's played by Tiny Ron. But moments like that where you describe, you know, where he shoots the net instead of just gunning people down, I mean, that's part of the whole sort of retro sensibility and sort of that whole PG vibe. And that's one of the things I really like about the movie is how sort of innocent it all is.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, do you know when it was being considered to be to having been released under Touchstone, was it always Joe Johnston attached?
Yeah, as far as I know.
Okay.
As far as I know, he was the only director who was ever attached. And we'll talk about Joe Johnston again in a little bit because he has an interesting filmography. But doing a little bit of research about The Rocketeer, there were a lot of people that they wanted to offer the movie to, a lot of movie stars. Apparently Johnny Depp came very close to playing the part.
Oh, okay.
Which I think is interesting. I don't think it would have had the effect on his career that like a Captain Jack Sparrow eventually did, but it would have been really his first entry into this sort of a franchise possibility.
Yeah.
An interesting person who turned it down apparently after Johnny Depp fell through, Vincent D'Onofrio. Can you
interesting is the word.
Right? Can you imagine The Rocketeer with Vincent D'Onofrio in the lead?
Take me back for a second. What exactly was his appeal in 1991?
I don't know. I mean, Full Metal Jacket was still, I think, the movie that everybody really knew him for.
And that screams Great American Hero.
Yeah, right.
So
they wanted the Rocketeer to shoot a bunch of Nazis and then turn the gun around on himself and blow the back of his head out at the end of the movie.
Yeah. And then a whole different movie ensues after that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Where they go to a factory in England that pretends to be Vietnam.
Yep.
Joe Johnston, I think, is the guy who specifically fought for Billy Campbell. He wanted an unknown, and he really liked Billy Campbell in the role. And I know now you have a theory that the Rocketeer should have made Billy Campbell a superstar, correct?
That is the theory. I mean, he's like a really handsome guy who's really pretty charismatic, I think, in this part. And I don't understand why. I mean, not only was he not a star, he pretty much disappeared.
He's continued to act. I mean, he pops up in stuff all the time.
Yeah, no, I understand that. But I mean, not in any sort of like part where you're like, oh, what a bold choice from Billy Campbell.
Maybe you didn't see his turn as the abusive husband to Jennifer Lopez in Enough.
Yeah. Well, that's in fact the only thing that I've seen him in. I don't know. I mean, I don't see enough films, in which case, sort of funny that I'm on a movie podcast, but I have seen The Rocketeer and I have seen Enough.
I think a lot of what he's done has been TV. He was on Once and Again for a couple of years, which is a show that my wife likes a lot. And he did a stint on The OC. Nothing that really rivals his leading man turn as Cliff Secord in The Rocketeer. And he is really good in that movie, but it's sort of in just a handsome, generic way. And I agree that he has charisma, but because the movie didn't do so hot, I don't think it's the kind of movie he could have broken out with.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we should maybe talk a little bit about the fact that The Rocketeer actually did fail when it came out. I mean, it made just enough to cover its budget, but particularly when you're talking about a Disney movie, you know, they really saturate the market with advertising. And I don't think they recouped their advertising budget. And, you know, when it's a Disney movie, they want you to make three times the budget because it's got the Disney muscle behind it. And this is coming off of, Batman had been such a huge success that a lot of studios were trying to create that next superhero franchise. That obviously Batman had an advantage in the marketplace because it has sort of this brand recognition. Everybody knows Batman, so of course they're going to go see the Batman movie. The Rocketeer was a character that most people didn't know. I read comics. I didn't know The Rocketeer.
Yeah.
So you're introducing people to a brand new character and then hoping that it catches on as a franchise. And it failed to do so, even though, again, I saw the movie in 1991. I wasn't 6 years old, but I really liked it.
Do you think it may have relied too heavily on that whole feeling of nostalgia that I was talking about, that kids don't particularly care that it takes place in an old Hollywood environment because it's not cool to them?
Maybe.
It's got a guy flying around and stuff. I mean, right. why didn't people like this?
I don't know, because again, I was young enough when I saw it that I couldn't appreciate that sense of nostalgia, even though I think I responded to it without totally understanding why. It just felt a little different than other movies I had seen. It was less cynical. It was more upbeat. It gave license to have some cool production design and some neat costumes that maybe you don't see in every movie. And it worked for, you know, Indiana Jones. So I don't, you know, there's a theory that it could still work for a movie like The Rocketeer, but for whatever reason, it didn't quite catch on. And in a way, I'm kind of glad, not that I, you know, want the movie to fail, but I think had they tried to duplicate its success with a sequel, that it might have ruined what's kind of a special thing.
Yeah, that's probably a good point. I was really intrigued with some of the part, like if I could direct the conversation to like, and this speaks to sort of the you know, keeping it Disney, to use a, you know, whatever, just you know, keeping it sort of kid friendly and whatnot.
Right.
There are some bits to do with like physical comedy and stuff that sort of pop up here, like when again at the South Seas Club. I feel like we'll talk about some other scenes at some point, but my God, it's such a rallying point for all the interesting stuff that happens in the film. Well, he's pretending to be the waiter.
Yeah.
He does like you know, where he sort of like spills the soup and sort of futzes with the dishes, and then he's in an effort to sort of eavesdrop on their conversation, he starts fluffing some, like he starts adjusting the flowers.
Yeah.
It's clear that these people don't do comedy very much. I mean, you have in that scene, Jennifer Connelly, Timothy Dalton, Billy Campbell, probably three of the funniest people in Hollywood at that point. But the film's sort of full of like little moments like that, that yeah. I appreciate the effort of, and even in my steadfast love of it, I'm like, I point to they do seem awkward and somewhat forced.
Right. It works more so because it's of a piece, not because any particular moment stands out as really funny, but it adds to the overall
it all sort of plays.
Tone. Yeah. Right. Exactly. It's interesting too, that Timothy Dalton, at the time that this movie came out, and he's this beloved guy that turns out to be the villain, but at the time that this movie came out, he was James Bond.
More like Lames Bond.
Whoa, zing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, was he still the Bond of the moment?
Yeah.
When was License to Kill? That was 89. So
License to Kill would have been 89. So, okay. I mean, I don't know, you know, he didn't make any more movies after that, but they hadn't yet announced that there was another Bond. So he was
right.
Still,
okay. So, yeah,
he was still the current Bond. So I think it's interesting that he sort of fucked with his image that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's great. He should play villains more often, because between this and Hot Fuzz, he's really great at sort of that charming, smiling a-hole.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, he's just sort of got like that sort of like that. He's got that shit-eating grin on his face, like right. Whenever he's trying to like when. Well, and it speaks not only to his talents, but actually how interesting the character is. Like the fact that when he's trying to seduce Jenny, they have that little bit about how he just is quoting lines from his own movies.
Right,
there.
Right.
That's like really great. The fact yeah. that they would go so far as to say, "Oh, he's really." Like a shell of everything that you think he is. He's not right. actually too dashing or like suave or anything like that. He's just spouting these things that he knows from because he was in these movies.
Right.
The other thing that I like sort of in that vein is that the movie is careful not to, it doesn't really take the whole thing too seriously. And again, that's because it's sort of kid driven, but like the big moment where he's talking to Jenny, again, this takes place in the South Seas Club. You know, when he pulls her into the bush and he says, you know, brace yourself for a shock. I'm the Rocketeer. In that moment, which in any other movie is like, oh my God, he told her. She doesn't even know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
She's like, the Rock-a-Who?
The Rock-a-Who.
The Rock-a-Who. And he
says, the Rock-a-Who is what the movie should have been called.
Yeah, probably. I think more people would have been intrigued to go see it.
But yeah, it's, I like that they undercut those moments.
Yeah, it really works.
And I will say, for as inclined as I am to sort of roll my eyes, I genuinely do like the gag at the end of the movie when the Zeppelin crashes into the Hollywood Land sign.
And well, no, wait a minute. The Zeppelin does not crash into it. Neville Sinclair.
When
he takes off on the pack.
Right.
You know, he removes the chewing gum.
That's right.
And then he goes crashing into the land. And like
takes
you say,
out
yeah,
the land, and that's how Hollywood is invented.
That's how it happens.
Yeah.
And like you said, you're right. Like the eye rolling, you might be inclined to do that, but I think that's just, that's so ballsy to just be like, yep, in the world that we created,
right.
That's how that happened. And that's why it is the way it is now. The other moment that's sort of like that is when they're in Howard Hughes's office, who's played by Terry O'Quinn, who went on to be in Lost, which is just real. And I think he's really great in it too. He gets that great shot in the beginning of it. When he says, you know, tell him the dream is over, tell him Howard Hughes says so.
Yeah.
And the fire, you know, that you get the fire wipe. That's great.
He is great. And when I saw the movie in 1991, I'm pretty sure I had no idea who Howard Hughes was and like didn't right. know that it was based on a real guy. I just thought, oh, he's Howard Hughes, the character who invented the jetpack.
That's right.
Terry O'Quinn, by the way, I just found out, is a gay man.
I think I knew that, actually. Here's some trivia for the the fives of listeners, or the threes, whatever we've decided on, I took a class when I was at Illinois State University from his brother. His name is Tom Quinn. And he waited until the last day of class to say, hey, if you like TV shows, you can watch Lost. My brother Terry is on there.
No kidding.
And then someone said that he was gay.
At that moment, he was like, you guys should watch Lost. That's my brother. And someone like, that guy's gay.
No, someone actually asked.
Is that guy gay?
Yeah, someone said, yeah, is he gay, by the way?
What a weird.
No, I'm serious.
And that's really weird.
And then, wasn't Howard Hughes kind of gay? That's the second time I've referred to somebody as kind of gay.
Errol Flynn, kind of gay. Howard Hughes, kind of gay. I don't know. The Aviator did not make Howard Hughes kind of gay. That guy was nailing Katherine Hepburn.
Ava
Gardner, Gwen Stefani.
Terry O'Quinn's great.
Yeah. Entire cast is actually really great. That is something that I noticed as I was watching it again. They did a really great job of casting. Again, because they're going for this kind of throwback vibe, they cast very specific types.
Mm-hmm.
It's a movie almost entirely populated by character actors.
Yes.
So that you don't have to spend any time developing who these people are. You just know instantly, even by looking at them. And really, every role in the movie is really well cast and pretty great. The only guy I didn't like, I would say, is Tiny Ron as Lothar. Because he is unable to speak through that prosthetic.
Yeah.
It's like a Muppet. Like, his chin moves, and it has nothing to do with what his lines that are looped are. You know what I mean? I mean, he's fine in the part. I don't mean to say that he does a bad job, but it's just... But again, it gives the movie sort of this handmade quality that I like, and that jumps into watching it again. I mean, the special effects, which were, I guess, sort of cutting edge at the time, aren't anymore.
No, not at all. I'm glad you broached that.
But I like that. It's interesting because I watch it and I'm nostalgic for practical effects. So I'm feeling nostalgic for 1991 while feeling nostalgic for 1930. You know what I mean? It's like this nostalgia on top of this nostalgia, and the world caves in on itself. Life becomes a Philip K. Dick novel, and I don't know, but
this is really taking some turns. This is great. The other guy that I really like, who's like you said, everybody's just sort of cut to fit this sort of this like caricature of a person. John Polito plays Bigelow, the guy who runs the airfield.
Yeah.
And like, from the minute you see him, you're like, oh yeah, that's a guy who's like really interested in showmanship and saving a buck.
Right. Right.
And that's what his arc amounts to before he gets broken in half by Tiny Ron.
Not cool, Tiny Ron.
Well, what are you going to do? I like the addition of a character like Tiny Ron in that, you have Neville Sinclair, who's the bad guy. And then this just the guy who's just sort of this otherworldly muscle.
Right.
And just sort of a brute. And like you said, with the facial, it's such an odd choice to make him like literally an old timey Hollywood monster.
Yeah,
in this old timey Hollywood movie, he looks like Frankenstein.
Yeah, he looks like he came right out of a comic book. And aside from the central conceit of a guy who wears a mask and flies with a jetpack, there's not a lot of necessarily comic booky things about the movie. But Lothar is definitely one of the most comic booky elements of the movie. And again, it works because if you're able to, it's something I come back to again and again on the F This Movie podcast, where, after you watch a movie, you're either sort of on board with it or you're not. And you can have problems with a movie, but you ultimately are on board with it or you're not. And so if you're willing to accept this world that the Rocketeer creates, you tend to like all these weird, potentially disparate elements that are thrown together.
If it's appealing enough to you in what it's trying to achieve, and you feel as though it's achieved it, you don't mind some of the, some of the hiccups along the way. I understand what you're saying. I mean, the film is not afraid to sort of escalate the ridiculousness level.
Right.
Like, things get more and more ridiculous until you find out that it's going, like, before it dawns on you that, oh yeah, this is going to end with an exploding Zeppelin maneuver. And if that weren't ridiculous enough, they are saved from that by Peavy and Howard Hughes flying in on his newfangled flying machine.
It is one of the few. Yeah, it is one of the few movies willing to go out on a ledge and make Howard Hughes an action hero.
Yes, I mean, I had actually sort of forgotten that, I remembered that it ended on an exploding Zeppelin and they got away. I had actually kind of forgotten that that's exactly how they got away.
Right.
Howard Hughes comes in and saves them on the earliest known version of a helicopter, is what it amounts to.
Right.
The gusto on the part of Joe Johnston and, God, who wrote this wonderful thing?
The comic book guy, the guy who created the comic book was Dave Stevens. Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo.
God bless him.
But I like the way that the movie sort of combines fiction with real history. We have a fake movie star, Neville Sinclair, interacting with real movie stars like W.C. Fields, and the way that it sort of rewrites history by making Howard Hughes the inventor of a jetpack who flies a helicopter, and, you know, Hollywood land is changed to Hollywood because this actor crashes into it in an exploding jetpack, that it rewrites history, but not necessarily in like an obnoxious way.
And
not in a way that's totally anachronistic. But the best example is that line from The Patriot where the girl sits down next to him and says, it's a free country. Well, it will be, you know, that kind of thing where you just, you can't stop throwing up in your own mouth.
An apt comparison, I think is like movies that sort of take place in a bygone era, but aren't afraid to sort of mess with it. I mean, Inglourious Basterds is sort of the overwhelming master of that now. I mean, he killed Hitler in it. Now he ended up dying. They care to make their own presumptions about how that transpired in their narrative. But again, it's all about like being able to tell a cohesive enough story that you're like, yeah, all right, I'll be on board with that. Can we switch gears and talk about Jennifer Connelly for a while?
I would be willing to make this a regular show just about Jennifer Connelly, but only Jennifer Connelly up to a certain point.
Well, what's your cutoff? Are you talking about up to a certain point in this movie or in her career?
In her career.
Oh, okay.
Because she's
cutting off at Dark Water or before Dark Water?
Before Dark Water. Because I'll be honest, I fucking forgot Dark Water existed.
Okay.
She became this husk of a human being who seems joyless and lifeless and dull and is sort of gaunt and not the unbelievably beautiful woman that she used to be.
Are we thinking Requiem for a Dream?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I hate to nail it down to such a specific point, but it's possible that it was the moment where she was ass to ass with another girl trying to score drugs that my love for, and it's not because I'm judging her. Listen,
no,
I'm not judging Jennifer Connelly going ass to ass with another girl for drugs. But that does seem to be the point where her career took a turn. I mean, more realistically, it's A Beautiful Mind.
Okay, yeah, that's probably. And when was that? Was 01 or something?
Yeah.
Well, that wasn't a whole lot of fun for anyone involved.
A Beautiful Mind?
Yeah.
Yeah, least of all me, because I fucking hate that movie.
Yeah. Me too. She's so great. She's so we went on about the casting, and this is a prime example of it, because she looks like she could have been in that era.
Absolutely.
She has that classic sort of timeless look. She's really, you know, robust and sort of help me out with adjectives, you know, hot as all fuck.
Yes.
Comes to mind.
Hot as all fuck.
And just great. And has, and like you said, she had become joyless, but she's really sort of effervescent in this.
Yeah.
And just kind of, you see her and you're like, oh yeah, there's a girl worth doing this for. I think that's important in movies where the female characters are a little more than just being, you know, sort of whisked away. Now, she does sort of stand up for herself. I mean, she knocks him out with a vase, but then she's captured again shortly thereafter. Right. So, I mean, you know, in movies where it's just a thing where the girls are just going to be pursued, they really have to be likable. And she really, really is. She's got it in spades.
She is. And I think it's interesting that she is so likable and sweet and seemingly innocent and really does feel like this all-American girl, despite the fact that she is really, really sexy. And she downplays her sexiness in the movie, yes. I think. You know, except for I think the first time we see her, she's just like rolling a stocking up her leg. So that's like, get it, everyone, she's hot. But for the most part, you know, she's not really seen as a sexual person in the movie. And I just have to think that if The Rocketeer were made now, and I don't think it would be.
No.
Certainly not the way that it was in 1991. But I feel like if it was made now, obviously Jennifer Connelly wouldn't be playing the part. And any actress that was playing the part would either A, not downplay their own sexiness, because I feel like sort of the crop of young actresses now, that's one of the only tools in their chest, that they have to be sexy. And if they weren't, I think they would do this thing that's like a very conscious choice. The comparison that I want to make isn't accurate. But when you think of like the Hudsucker Proxy and the performance that Jennifer Jason Leigh gives in that movie, and now it's the performance she gives in that movie is very much in the tone of that movie. So I'm not faulting her, but
Okay. Where
it's the kind of performance that exists to comment on the performances of the time.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So we would either get like a Jessica Biel who would, you know, just make it sort of overtly sexual and boring because she's Jessica Biel, or we would get someone who's maybe a slightly better actress, but who wouldn't be able to resist the urge to make it sort of a caricature of a 1930s actress.
That's interesting. Yeah. I'm trying to think about who they would even go for. I mean, who would be that second person? Are we like a Zooey Deschanel type?
Or maybe, like, I mean, I'm thinking of like Renee Zellweger and Leatherheads.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, where you're sort of just winking at, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Because that's the only way you can get away with not being sexy. But Jennifer Connelly manages to do it. And again, I think because it's, even though the movie, you know, I guess it's almost 20 years old, which is unbelievable. It's definitely from a different era, and I think they could get away with doing that. But Jennifer Connelly is unreal and really didn't come onto my radar until Career Opportunities.
Is that where they're locked in a Target?
Yes. And that's almost around the same time as The Rocketeer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that. Like, that was like in the late night rotation on HBO for a while when I first had HBO.
Yeah.
A charming film in its own right. Maybe we'll F it later.
She's got the scene where she's on a rocking horse trying to seduce two bungling burglars. And it is something else, that scene. But yeah, I mean, I had seen Labyrinth. I didn't pay much attention to it because I'm not a person who loves Labyrinth. And I didn't pay that much. So I knew who she was, but I didn't pay that much attention to it. And it wasn't until Career Opportunities that I was like, oh my God, who is that person? And I remained that way for the rest of the 90s.
I think it's become our duty now to contact her people, her handlers or whatever.
All right.
And send them a strongly worded letter. Or not strong, like not angry, but just sort of an eloquent letter with a cop with this section of the podcast. Say, can we get her to think and look and feel like this
again? Yeah, bring back the old Jennifer Connelly.
I don't know. I miss JC.
She tried to do likable
Has she ever given a whirl at like a romantic comedy?
She was just in He's Just Not That Into You year. And that's not a movie I dislike, although it's not a movie I particularly love. But and she tried to be likable and warm and like a regular person, because she doesn't give a lot of regular person roles. She gives sort of very serious, dramatic roles. And I didn't really buy it. And it's not that she's bad. It's just that she's just become so cold, I feel like.
Yeah.
And she didn't use – cold would have been the last word – I used to describe her in the 90s.
Yeah, in The Rocketeer. Maybe Paul Bettany did it to her?
I know Paul Bettany did it to her. I mean, I know that he did it to her a lot.
Well, yeah, I mean, they got kids and stuff, and maybe they even did it for fun once or twice. I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it would be fun anymore. But let's talk about Joe Johnston.
Yeah, go for it.
Because I think Joe Johnston was absolutely the right director to make this movie, and he's making Captain America now as we speak.
Uh-huh.
And I don't have a lot of faith in that movie or in him as the director of that movie, except for the fact that he made The Rocketeer.
Now, but like you said, the climate now is so very different in terms of what people need out of superhero films.
Yeah.
So now, before The Rocketeer, wasn't the only thing on his resume Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
Correct. Which he wasn't even the original director for.
That's right. That's right.
Stuart Gordon got fired off that movie.
That's right. So
because someone finally rented Reanimator and said, "We did what? We hired who to make this movie?"
Joe Johnston, he just like we've been talking about. I mean, he just sort of embraced, I don't want to say campiness, because the film isn't really campy.
No, and that's one of the things I like about it. It comes sort of, you know, Timothy Dalton especially comes right to the verge of camp.
Yes.
But it never becomes campy.
It's pretty sincere,
yeah.
But still really fun.
Right.
And I don't know if that's something that, like, I mean, did you see The Wolfman?
I did see The Wolfman.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's got some problems with some other things, but I mean, tonally, I thought it was all right.
I like the fact that he tried to do it, period. I like the tone that he tried to achieve. And again, Joe Johnston really sort of traffics in nostalgia, whether it's The Rocketeer or October Sky, mm-hmm. or Hidalgo or The Wolf. You know, Hidalgo was an attempt to sort of redo The Rocketeer, just sort of this old-fashioned throwback to kind of a kind of an Indiana Jones kind of movie, or The Wolfman. And I appreciate that, and I think that's what might make him the right guy for Captain America, because I think they are trying to go period with that. But I don't know.
I don't know.
Because I don't think he's ever made a great movie. The Rocketeer, I think, is still his best movie by far.
Yeah, I think so, too.
I have very little love for Jumanji.
What about Jurassic Park 3?
I think Jurassic Park 3, I think it works. I mean, it's...
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, I really, really, really hate it.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. I think maybe because The Lost World left such a bad taste in my mouth.
Yeah.
Because I really hate The Lost World.
Okay. Well, this might be something we can F later, too, because I kind of want to get into this, but I don't want to stray too far from the task at hand. But I mean, so much has happened. I mean, you know, I mean, we don't have to detail how, you know, directors sort of change as sort of their egos change or whatever. But I mean, so much has happened to them since. I mean, if you're willing to make the conceit that The Rocketeer is the first movie that he was ever the director on, from the jump, you know, there's any number of ways that he could do Captain America, like you said, as we speak. I don't really know where that leaves us as far as, I mean, it's probably going to be just some more, you know, pandering type stuff, wouldn't you imagine?
Pandering in what way?
Just, I mean, you like there are certain conceits that I mean, all these sort of new, well, especially the ones that are building to the Avengers thing, like that Iron Man and Hulk did. I like those movies, but I mean, they just sort of hit certain benchmarks without any sort of real flair, I don't think.
Okay.
I mean, just because it's such an odd circumstance under which to make a film where you know they're all going to rally at some point.
Right.
Down the road.
Right.
But like you said, going period, sort of embracing the fact that, you know, the stuff doesn't always have to be the most serious stuff ever. You can leave that to Chris Nolan or, you know, whoever else. I don't know. I mean, I guess cautious optimism is something that we could say.
Yeah, definitely. Because again, I mean, he hasn't really made a movie that I've hated. Jumanji probably comes the closest.
Yeah.
And I don't even hate that movie. I could give two shits about it. I don't like it. It doesn't work. It has Robin Williams. And I don't think he's good at doing dark. And I think that's part of the problem with The Wolfman, is I don't think he's a particularly dark director. When he does sort of light and upbeat, as he has tended to do, I think mm-hmm. the movies work better. And I think that's I think that's the vibe he's going to do Captain America in. But I also worry because, like you said, you know, we now have a different expectation for a comic book movie, and yeah. whether it's Marvel Studios or whether it's people at Paramount saying, like, look, you know, The Dark Knight is the standard now. You need to make this a little edgier. I think that's the wrong way to go. But at the same time, like you said, he still has to set up a movie. It can't be so tonally different from the other movies that are coming out that it.
That's what I'm saying is that they all sort of have to be cohesive. It's exactly. Sort of weird.
Because it has to fit into this other movie that they're working towards.
I know.
But at the same time, you know, I wouldn't say that Iron Man or the Hulk were particularly dark. The Louis Leterrier Hulk, yeah. not the Ang Lee one. That thing is that's the Nick Nolte bubble movie.
As it's come to be known, yeah.
Yeah, what's your main bad guy? Well, it's a Nick Nolte bubble. Awesome.
Well,
here's $100 million.
I mean, he melts into things and hits you with them, is what he does. Doesn't he like, his hand goes into a desk and then he hits the guy with the desk or something.
I sort of remember, but I'll be honest, I don't remember all that well.
It's not for everybody, okay?
No,
it's not
for everybody. Are you a fan of the Ang Lee Hulk?
No, not
okay.
Now I'm messing around. I wasn't messing around. But no, yeah, that's got some problems.
Yeah. Well, I don't think enough people have seen The Rocketeer because it's a movie that, like I said, I definitely think is underrated. I don't think there's that many people who have seen it that dislike it.
No, I don't think so. But like you said, it's just sort of underviewed.
Right. But it's a movie that I think most people that have seen it say, like, yeah, I like that movie. You know, I think it's a hard movie to dislike. But I also think that it's possible that you are sort of the last generation that I can say that about.
You probably it won't sort of stand tall over the, you know, for the rest of time, which is sad. I don't know. I've always thought, and I'm not joking here. I've always thought it would go over well as one of those movies that that theaters like show at midnight.
Yeah, maybe.
Just as sort of like, I mean, there's two ways to go with that. You can show really gross, weird things like Rocky Horror Picture Show or something, or things that are just really fun and nostalgic. I think it would be an interesting, now no one's going to do that.
Right. There is a whole cult built around the movie though. They call themselves Finheads.
Now I feel like someone's making jokes.
I swear that's true.
Wait, are you serious?
Yeah, there's a group of like the Rocketeer, you know, not, I don't think they're like the official Rocketeer fan club, but like the same way that people that love Firefly call themselves Browncoats, like this, the followers of the Rocketeer call themselves Finheads.
Oh, okay. Well,
so there is a movement, you know, a pro Rocketeer movement that exists.
Clearly, I've got to get my ass to a meeting. I'm in the wrong place. I got to get to a Finheads meeting.
Would you call The Rocketeer one of your favorite movies?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in the team picture to use a, you know, sports terminology, but I don't
know what the fuck that means.
Well, you get the team together and you take a picture.
All right.
And you know, it basically, I mean, it. If you were making a team, if you had to pick people on the playground,
all right,
you know, as like, you know, to just to be the best, it's, you know, it's in the picture is what I'm saying. So,
all right.
Well, cool. So I mean, we've already sort of stepped on sort of how you like to conclude these things with the what the legacy is,
right?
And we've established that the legacy is that it'll be lost forever. Except the Finheads, which is sort of sad.
Yeah, you know, not the. Hopefully, Captain America is the movie that manages to break through, making sort of the retro superhero movie, because other attempts have been made and have been unsuccessful. Are you familiar with the Billy Zane, the Phantom?
The Phantom. Yeah, well, that's another thing that I actually rewatched relatively recently and liked it a lot more than I remember doing. Yeah. So you can see, much like The Rocketeer too, you can see why it didn't really find an audience.
Right.
Well, The Phantom even more so. It's just sort of weird, and it just sort of incongruous.
But I like The Phantom though for a lot of the same reasons that I like The Rocketeer. Although The Phantom, I think, is a little more self-aware.
Yes.
And
well, Treat Williams. I mean, he's like on another goddamn planet.
he's so great. I love him in that movie.
It works for what they're doing.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Well, that's an interesting way to sort of look at it. The fact that it could be the return of this kind of way to make superhero movies. I hope so.
It works.
I think on the weekend, whatever weekend that Captain America comes out, I'm going to be that hipster doofus who's saying, you know what? This will probably be great. You know what else is great? The Rocketeer.
Nice.
Go rent it.
Nice.
I'll be that guy.
Be that guy after fucking go to Sex and the City 2 and people are like, I loved it. I'm crying. They got married. Be like, you know what else is great? Rocketeer.
Rocketeer. I'm going home to watch it now. Who's coming with?
All right. Well, I guess that'll do it for the Rocketeer. I should say that there's an email now for the F This Movie podcast.
Okay.
And it's fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. So if you have a comment about the show or you want Alex's phone number or you have a movie that you would like to see F'd sometime in the future, fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Do you have anything you want to plug? You got that Lost bullshit you're doing.
It's all the same thing. You go to tv.insidepulse.com, and then there's a tab for authors, and my name starts with A, and you'll see Alex Lawson. That'll bring you to all my shit that posts every Wednesday. So,
what are you going to do when that show goes off the air?
Don't know. Don't want to think about it. No, I don't know. I mean, I'll do some other things. I do Friday Night Lights, too. That goes up on Saturday.
So. That show's going off the air, too, though.
Yeah, but that's got a whole other season yet, so... We'll cross the bridge when we get
there. My suggestion, start blogging about rules of engagement. That shit has staying power. All right, well, thank you, and we'll see you guys next time.